Here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Welcome back to Evening Under Lamplight. We're broadcasting, as always, from the studios of Cambridge 105, community radio in your city, following on from the bouncy music of Kipper the Cat, and offering you, on this, our 163rd episode, an eerie and perhaps a little puzzling moment in Dante's Inferno. You'll see what I mean in a few minutes, but what is for sure is that we're going to hear two of the most acclaimed stories in the Inferno, two different kinds of confessions. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, and I'm inviting you to attend. And you'll be glad you did, if I can be so presumptuous. We're covering cantos 26 and 27 of the Inferno this evening. Having left the serpent-filled, shape-shifting ditch of the thieves, as recounted last time, you'll recall, Dante and Virgil now cross over the eighth ditch in this region of fraud, and looking down into the ditch, Dante sees something that reminds him of when you sit out on the hillside in summer and see the lights of fireflies down below, little dots of light moving around. Dante moves a little closer and sees that these lights are moving flames of fire, walking or gliding along, it's not clear. Dante stops for a moment to tell us that in describing what comes next, he's going to restrain his talents, lest he misuse his gift by overstepping the bounds and cura che virtù non guidi, run where virtue fails to guide them. There will be none of those fantastic shape-shifting scenes he'd given us last time, and none of that bragging, justly, about how spectacular his descriptions were. This is an important statement, and we'll see that this kind of restraint on one's talents is just what the characters in this Bolgia had not practiced. So, standing on the bridge over this eighth ditch, Dante keeps looking at these moving flames and suddenly sees that, walking towards them, one of these flames has a kind of double tip. What's that all about? Virgil explains that this double flame contains the souls of both Ulysses and Diomedes, two heroes of the Trojan War who often worked or fought together. Let's hear what they have to say when they get closer, Dante says. Well, yes, certainly, Virgil replies, but you keep quiet. Let me speak, since they'll be more likely to agree to our request if I make it. And it's always puzzled Dante's scholars just what Virgil means here. Is he going to speak to them in Greek? That's unlikely for several reasons. Is it because Dante's too modern? We can't be sure. But that's okay. We don't have to know everything. And so Virgil addresses the double flame and asks if one of them will please give an account of his last moments in life as he came to die. And it's Ulysses, the greater of the two tips of flame, who speaks up. Of course. It always was Ulysses who had the gift of powerful speech. That was one of the dances from Stravinsky's Firebird, as the one half of this double flame begins quivering, and then the sound of words vibrates from the very tip. Thus, Ulysses begins speaking. What does he say? Remember, he's been asked to speak about how he came to die. And Dante, the poet, gives us here another amazing performance. The story he has Ulysses relate is, unlike almost every other part of the Divine Comedy, not drawn from some earlier source. Dante seems to have made up this story. He wouldn't have known Homer's Odyssey, in which we are told that Odysseus, that is Ulysses, turned down the offer to spend the rest of his days with the beautiful goddess Calypso, preferring to return to his beloved wife, and then finally made it home safe after the Trojan War. Dante wouldn't have known that, but in his version, Ulysses turns his back on his home and, after spending over a year with the divine sorceress Circe, continues his travels. He directs the ship westward across the Mediterranean and through the Straits of Gibraltar, otherwise known as the Pillars of Hercules. Huge cliffs put there by strong man Hercules to warn sailors that they were forbidden to travel any further. In olden days, it was generally thought that there was nothing in the southern hemisphere but water. Ulysses ignores that warning, and we'll see what happens. Well, here's what he says in the Hollander's translation. When I took leave of Circe, who for a year and more beguiled me there, not tenderness for a son, nor filial duty toward my aged father, nor the love I owed Penelope that would have made her glad, could overcome the fervor that was mine to gain experience of the world and learn about man's vices and his worth. And so I set forth on the open deep with but a single ship and that handful of shipmates who had not deserted me. I and my shipmates had grown old and slow by the time we reached the narrow strait where Hercules marked off the limits, warning all men to go no farther. On the right-hand side, I left Seville behind. On the other, I had left Ceuta. O brothers, I said, who in the course of 100,000 perils at last have reached the west to such brief wakefulness of our senses as remains to us, do not deny yourselves the chance to know, following the sun, the world where no one lives. Consider how your souls were sown. You were not made to live like brutes or beasts, but to pursue virtue and knowledge. With this brief speech, I had my companions so ardent for the journey, I could scarce have held them back. And having set our stern to sunrise, in our mad flight, we turned our oars to wings, always gaining on the left. 5 times the light beneath the moon had been rekindled, and as often been put out since we began our voyage on the deep, when we could see a mountain, distant, dark and dim. In my sight, it seemed higher than any I had ever seen. We rejoiced, but joy soon turned to grief, for from that unknown land there came a whirlwind that struck the ship head on. 3 times it turned her and all the waters with her. At the 4th, our stern reared up, the prow went down, as pleased another, until the sea closed over us. So that's Ulysses' story. Unlike the great Roman hero Aeneas, always motivated by pietas, that is, reverence for the gods and for the family, Ulysses ignores his duty to others. No tender longing to see his son and help his son grow into a mature man. No concern to return to comfort his father in his old age. And especially no response to the love of his devoted wife. No, instead, he sails in the alto mare aperto, the deep open sea, accompanied by the few men left to him. But it's important to notice that, as he tells us, he and his men are vecchi e tardi, old and tired. They've done a lot in their lives, and it's worn them out. Now is the period of life when they should rest and consolidate themselves, but no, that kind of life is not for Ulysses. He heads to the gates of the Atlantic, the Pillars of Hercules, knowing it's forbidden to go beyond. And then he goes beyond, spurring his men to go with him, their oars acting like wings, propelling them on what Ulysses now, looking back from his hellish viewpoint, what he now recognizes as a folle volo, a mad flight into the unknown. For 5 months they sail southwards in the Atlantic, until one day they see up ahead the shape of an enormous mountain rising out of the sea, where they expected to find, well, they know not what. We'll learn later that this is the Mountain of Purgatory, the solitary piece of land in the southern hemisphere, according to Dante's cartology. These living men are forbidden to come near it, and up comes a whirlwind, hitting the ship head on, spinning it 3 times around and around and around, and then on the 4th spin, raising the stern of the ship so the front, the prow, plunges deep into the water, and the sea finally overwhelms them, and Ulysses' soul is sent down into hell. Why hell? Well, let's see if we can work it out. Ulysses wants to divenir del mondo esperto e delle vizi umani e del valore. He wants to gain experience of the world and of men's vices and of their virtues. This is a noble aim in its place. Such experience, of course, is just what Dante himself is seeking. It's the whole purpose of his journey through hell and upwards to the peak of the heavens. He's on the journey to learn about the world and see all these manifestations of sin and moral blindness, and then in the Purgatorio and Paradiso, to experience the very highest in human spirit. The difference is, though, that Ulysses just seeks this experience for its own sake and has followed his own desires instead of following where duty and love would lead him, and the necessity of composing his soul now at the ending of his life. Both Ulysses and Dante journey beyond the limits of normal human experience, but Ulysses does so rashly, through self-will, while Dante does so under the guidance and protection of divine grace. But the problem arises when we consider that Ulysses is the kind of behavior we tend to celebrate today, isn't it? Breaking boundaries, not being constrained by the prohibition earlier generations have set for us. We want to experience it all for ourselves. Ulysses' position is very modern. He sees that he's getting old and has tanto picciola vigilia di nostri sensi, such a brief vigil of our senses left to us now that we're getting on in years. And so he wants to pack in as much as he can, his bucket list. And it's a noble bucket list, not cruising in the Mediterranean, not climbing high mountains or going to nice restaurants, not speeding in a luxury racing car or getting sexy women crawling all over him, but seguir virtute e conoscenza, following virtue and knowledge. That is, pursuing, seeking after what is good and true. A noble bucket list. But out of keeping for this part of life, at least in Dante's scheme of things. Ulysses knows his time is limited. He knows the first part of the Latin tag, vita brevis, life is short. But he forgets the second part, respice finem. Therefore look towards the end, prepare for old age and death. Not by trying to accumulate more and more experience and knowledge, but by examining our own life and getting our own house into order and playing the nobler role of the wise elder. Or as the great Michel de Montaigne put it late in his life, 'tis past time for me to become other than what I am. I have no need of goods of which I can make no use. Of what use is knowledge to him who has lost his head? My world is at an end, my form expired. And he said this not in sorrow or grief, but in joyful understanding that this kind of inner reflection was what he was being called to at this time of his life.
I like old people. Don't you? They never tell you what you shouldn't do. They buy you toys and candy, and extra toys are dandy, and Nanny's always baking something new. I like old people, I like them. Don't you? They're nice old people, they're nice. They tell you funny stories once and twice. Course they're never in a hurry, and they don't have to worry that there's a zillion things you have to do. I like old people,
Well, you never know what's coming next on Evening Under Lamplight, do you? Well, that was just to lighten things up, a bit of Bissell Schmaltz from Danny Kaye's children's album, Mommy Give Me a Drink of Water. Check it out sometime. Mommy Give Me a Drink of Water. Water. Old people should have the time to be wise elders and loving grandparents, because they're never in a hurry, and they don't have to worry that there's a zillion things they have to do. I like old people, don't you? This is something Ulysses never turned his mind or heart to. There's a slightly different twist to this in Tennyson's poem Ulysses, which is based not on the traditional myths, but on Dante's story here. Tennyson presents a slightly different version from Dante, though. Instead of having Ulysses go straight from Circe's bed on his journey to unknown lands, not even stopping home for a visit, Tennyson pictures Ulysses back home in Ithaca, the Trojan War over, all the toils of his sea voyage behind him, now trying to administer justice and rule over a savage race that hoard and sleep and feed and know not me. Me, one of the greatest heroes of all times, they know not me. And my wife, my Penelope, now just an aged wife, not the passionate lover I once knew. I cannot rest from travel, he says. I will drink life to the lees. I will live a life fitting for a great hero. All those adventures I have had have made me what I am now, and I must continue those adventures. How dull it is, he says, to pause, to make an end, to rust unburnished, not to shine in use, as though to breathe were life. He rejects the idea Montaigne had expressed. It would be vile to hoard myself, as he puts it, while his spirit yearns to experience more things. Picture a film of this. We begin with the camera panning the small, rocky island of Ithaca, and then focusing in on the king's hall, not a very grand hall after all, and coming to rest on Ulysses, sitting on the throne or judgment bench, as the ragged, paltry subjects shuffle off. He looks at us and shares his yearning to get out of this. And then I imagine he gets up, and as he talks to us, he leads us out, perhaps to the marketplace, where he points from a distance to his son Telemachus, chatting with the people there, relaxed and friendly towards them, yet also with something regal in his bearing. This is my son, mine own Telemachus, Ulysses tells us, and explains that he's about to leave the whole kingdom to his son, who is perfectly suited to the duties required of a king of Ithaca. He works his work, I mine. And then he takes us down to the port, where he sees the mariners at work preparing a ship. And he forgets about us and turns to address his men, echoing the words Dante gives to his Ulysses. You and I are old, he tells them. Old age hath yet his honor and his toil. Death closes all. But something ere the end, some work of noble note, may yet be done, not unbecoming men that strove with gods. Nothing can daunt him. They will not go gentle into that dark night, but will strive to achieve even more things worthy of their past achievements. And though old and weak, they're still going to fight on with this battle cry. And though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield.
To dream the impossible dream, to fight the unbeatable foe, to bear with unbearable sorrow, to run where the brave dare not go, to right the unrightable wrong, to love pure and chaste from afar, to try when your arms are too weary, to reach the unreachable star. This is my quest, to follow that star, no matter how hopeless, no matter how far, to fight for the right without question or pause, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. And I know if I'll only be true to this glorious quest, that my heart will lie peaceful and calm when I'm laid to my rest. And the better for this, that one man scorned and covered with scars still strove with his last ounce of courage to reach the unreachable stars. This is my quest, to follow right without question or pause, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. And I know if I'll only be true to this glorious quest, that my heart will lie peaceful and calm when I'm laid to my rest. And the world will be better for this, that one man scorned and covered with scars still strove with his last ounce of courage.
Well, that was a stirring song, wasn't it? Brian Stokes Mitchell giving us The Impossible Dream from the Broadway musical Man of La Mancha. This is what Broadway does best, the glorious striving for one's dream, no matter how hopeless, no matter how far. This sort of thing really moved me when I was younger, but I'm now a little disturbed by its sentimentality, as though all you have to do is belt out these idealistic passions and all's well with the world. This is all very well in its place, but it's liable to put us out of balance if it makes us forget the other calls upon us. And remember, Don Quixote was, after all, insane for all his fine qualities, and Cervantes' novel is, for the most part, a satire. And just to remind you, this is Evening Under Lamplight with Robert Louis Abrahamson on Cambridge 105. We're looking at Canto 26 of Dante's Inferno, The Confession of Ulysses. Stay with us, as Rachel Maddow says. There's a lot more to come, including one more famous confessional passage, complete with a new kind of devil showing up.
When the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend. Evening under lamplight. It's Cambridge 105. Community radio in your city.
Thank you. Now, there's one more thing I want to attend to before we leave Ulysses. We have to jump up to the 20th century and to one of the most awful moments of that awful century, to Auschwitz. Sorry, we're doing Auschwitz tonight. To Auschwitz in the last year of the war, where the Italian chemist Primo Levi was incarcerated. As you probably know, he later gave us, in his book If This Be a Man, one of the best accounts of life in Auschwitz, its horrors and its moments of redeeming humanity. And there's a whole chapter in the book devoted to this canto in the Inferno and how Ulysses' speech helped connect Primo Levi to the humane world outside the camp. It gives us a rare insight into life in that death camp and the prisoner's desperate attempt to remember the Dante he, like all Italians, had studied in school. Levi introduces us to Jean, the piccolo of his commando, the messenger clerk of the chemist's workforce, where Levi was lucky enough to be placed. Jean, the piccolo, was Alsatian and spoke both French and German. And though one of the privileged inmates of the camp, he was generally liked by the prisoners. It was one warm June day when Jean chose Levi to accompany him to the kitchens to fetch that day's ration of watered-down soup. One could see the Carpathian Mountains covered in snow, Levi says. I breathed in the fresh air. I felt unusually lightheaded. They had to walk half a mile to the kitchens and then return with the pot weighing over 100 pounds. It was quite a tiring task, Levi tells us, but it meant a pleasant walk there without a load and the ever-welcome chance of getting near the kitchens. And Jean knew what he was doing. They walked slowly, taking the long way around. You know there's plenty of time, he tells Levi. Jean says that he wants to learn Italian, so Levi says, well, why not start now? The important thing is not to lose time, not to waste this hour. So what does Levi teach him? The Canto of Ulysses. Who knows how or why it comes into my mind, but we have no time to change. This hour is already less than an hour. If Jean is intelligent, he will understand. He will understand. Today I feel capable of so much. Who is Dante? What is the comedy? That curious sensation of novelty which one feels if one tries to explain briefly what the Divine Comedy is. How the Inferno is divided up. What are its punishments? Virgil is reason. Beatrice is theology. Jean pays great attention, and I begin slowly and accurately. L'omaggio al corno della fiamma antica cominciò a crollarsi mormorando. And on for 4 more lines, down to gitò voce di fuori e disse quando. And here I stop and try to translate. Disastrous. Poor Dante and poor French. All the same, the experience seems to promise well. Jean admires the bizarre simile of the tongue and suggests the appropriate word to translate antica, age old. And after, when I came, nothing. A hole in my memory. A fragment floats into my mind, not relevant, nor pity to my father, nor to the wedded love that should have comforted Penelope. Is it correct? So on the open sea I set forth. Of this line I'm certain, I'm sure. I can explain it to Jean. I can point out why Missime, I set forth, is not Je me mis. It is much stronger and more audacious. It is a chain which has been broken. It is throwing oneself on the other side of a barrier. We know the impulse well. The open sea. Jean has travelled by sea and knows what it means. It is when the horizon closes in on itself, free, straight ahead and simple, and there is nothing but the smell of the sea, sweet things, ferociously far away. open sea, open sea. I know it rhymes with left me and that small band of comrades that had never left me. But I cannot remember if it comes before or after that line. And the journey as well, the foolhardy journey beyond the Pillars of Hercules. How sad. I have to tell it in prose, a sacrilege. I have rescued only two lines, but they're worth stopping for. That none should prove so hardy to venture the uncharted distances. Oh, how many things there are to say, and the sun is already high, midday is near. I'm in a hurry, a terrible hurry. Here, listen, Piccolo, open your ears and your mind. You have to understand for my sake. Think of your breed. For brutish ignorance, your metal was not made. You were made men to follow after knowledge and excellence. It was as if I also was hearing it for the first time, like the blast of a trumpet, like the voice of God. For a moment, I forget who I am and where I am. Piccolo begs me to repeat it. Oh, how good Piccolo is. He is aware that it is doing me good. Or perhaps it is something more. Perhaps, despite the wan translation and the pedestrian rushed commentary, perhaps he has received the message. He has felt that it has to do with him, that it has to do with all men who toil, and with us in particular, and that it has to do with the two of us who dare to reason of these things with the poles for the soup on our shoulders. Forgive me, Piccolo, I have forgotten at least four triplets. That doesn't matter. Go on anyway. When at last hove up a mountain, grey with distance, and so lofty and so steep, I never had seen the like on any day. Yes, 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 so lofty and so steep. And the mountains, when one sees them in the distance, the mountains. Oh, Piccolo, Piccolo, say something, speak. Do not let me think of my mountains, which used to show up against the dusk of evening as I returned by train from Milan to Turin. Enough. One must go on. These are things that one thinks but does not say. Piccolo waits and looks at me. I would give today's soup to know how to connect the like on any day to the last lines. I try to reconstruct it through the rhymes. I close my eyes, I bite my fingers, but it is no use. The rest is silent. It is late, it is late. We have reached the kitchen. I must finish. And three times round she went in roaring smother with all the wet, with all the waters. At the fourth, the poop rose and the prow went down as pleased another. I keep Piccolo back. It is vitally necessary and urgent that he listen, that he understand this as pleased another before it is too late. Tomorrow he or I might be dead, or we might never see each other again. I must tell him, I must explain to him about the Middle Ages, about the so human and so necessary and yet unexpected anachronism of pagan Ulysses referring to another, that is, God, but still more something gigantic that I myself have only just seen in a flash of intuition, perhaps the reason for our fate, for our being here today. We are now in the soup queue, among the sordid, ragged crowd of soup carriers from other commandos. Those just arrived press against our backs. Kraut und Ruben! Kraut und Ruben. The official announcement is made that the soup today is of cabbages and turnips. Schuh et Nave. And over our heads, the hollow seas closed up. Well, that was the sea storm again and shipwreck from Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade, signalling both the end of Ulysses and his men and also the perception that came to Primo Levi that after this brief sharing of the great European culture, the life in death of Auschwitz had resumed and over our heads the hollow seas closed up. That line is the end of Levi's chapter. It's also the end of Canto 26. But Dante stays in this ditch of talking flames for another canto, and so we'll move on now to see who's coming up next. As that double flame containing Ulysses and Diomedes walks off, having given Virgil what Virgil had asked for, the account of the death of one of these two, another flame comes up, emitting just gibberish from its quivering tip. And before he tells us any more, Dante compares this howling noise to probably the most horrible form of torture mentioned in the whole poem so far. This is a torture not created in the mythical hell, but up here in our world by some of our fellow human beings, or at least so the Greek historians tell us. There was a ruler in Sicily who hired Perillus, an ingenious craftsman, to create an instrument to torture his enemies. Perillus constructed a hollow statue of a bull made of brass, into which the victim would be confined and then roasted alive. That's horrible, but what makes it even worse is that Perillus had so contrived the acoustics of this machinery that the screams of the tortured man passed through some piping so that it came out sounding like a bull's bellowing. Very amusing for the people viewing this, wasn't it? Well, not so amusing for Perillus, who, to punish his sadistic imagination that had thought of this, was appointed the first to try out the bull and have his shrieks turned into bull sounds. Well, this flame approaching Dante and Virgil sounds like that, vestiges of a human voice, but no human sounds. But when finally the vibrations of the words come to the tip of the flame, the sounds become a human voice. "I can tell from your accent," he says to Virgil, "that you're from Lombardy. What battles are going on there these days?" Like asking for the latest sports news. Virgil signals for Dante to reply, and Dante gives a long account of the warfare going on in that region of Italy. And then he asks who this flame is. "Oh," says the flame, "if I thought any word of this would get up to the living world out there, I'd never say anything. But since no one gets out of here alive, sure, I'll tell you my story." More fool him, right? It turns out that this is the great Guido da Montefeltro, one of the great generals of the previous generation, known as the Fox because of his craftiness in conducting warfare. His story parallels Ulysses in an important way. They both begin when the men are reaching old age. Ulysses saw old age as the time to go out on one grand final adventure. Guido is more traditional. He knows it's time to retire and prepare for death. "When I saw I had reached that stage of life," he says, "when all men ought to think of lowering sail and coiling up the ropes," we think of Ulysses, who raised sail at this point, "I grew displeased with what had pleased before. Repentant and shriven, I became a friar." Well, good for him. He repents of all the devious and violent actions of his past life and joins the Franciscans and hopes to end his days in a holy death, leading to eternity in heaven.
Sarà anima cui go in the name of God, the omnipotent.
But go in the name of God, the angel says to the dying soul in Elgar's Dream of Gerontius. And all's set up for Guido now to be welcomed in just this way. But then one day, the Pope, Boniface VIII, the Pope Dante never has anything good to say about, the Pope calls in Guido. Ecco Guido, ho bisogno di te, aiutami. Hey Guido, I need your help. Listen, here's the problem. I've got these enemies, see, holed up in the castle at Palestrina. I can't get them out. You're the fox, man. You'll know how I can get into that place. Tell me how to do this. Wait a minute, says Guido. I'm paraphrasing, you'll understand. Wait a minute. I'm not a general anymore. I'm a Franciscan. I don't do war anymore. I'm on the path to heaven. Come on, Guido, says the Pope. Who do you think you're dealing with? Some small-time criminal? I'm the Pope. I hold the keys to heaven, remember? I won't let you down. Look, I absolve you from sin right now. You're in the clear. Now tell me how to get those enemies of mine. Oh, well, okay, if you pardon me now, I suppose that's a good enough passport for me to get into heaven. And Guido tells him what to do. Lunga promessa, con l'attender corto. Long promise and short fulfillment. In other words, fraud of another kind. Make promises you don't intend to keep. And it worked, for Boniface, if not for Guido. Now, a little while later, Guido dies, surrounded, presumably, by his Franciscan brothers, everyone expecting another soul rising to heaven. In fact, Guido tells us, Saint Francis himself comes down to welcome Guido's soul and escort it up to heaven. But then, here's the amazing part of the story, but then, un di neri cherubini, one of the dark cherubim, shows up. Hold it, Francis, he shouts. This is a devil, right? Hold it, Francis. This one is not for you. It's mine, because of that fraudulent advice he gave the Pope. One may not be absolved without repentance, nor repent and wish to sin at the same time. And Don Guido goes into hell, where we find him. What was that all about? It's actually simple logic. If you sin, you can then be sorry that you sinned and repent and ask for forgiveness and then be forgiven, sincere in your hope never to commit that sin again. But you cannot be sorry for the sin and then go and commit the sin. Committing the sin means that you're still committed to it. That's not repentance. Even the Pope cannot get around this logical fallacy. Tough luck for Guido. He counseled fraud and was caught in a papal fraud himself. And that's the end of Guido's sorry tale, and he goes away full of grief. So that's that. But you may be asking yourself, what exactly is the sin being punished in this bolgia, this ditch? I haven't mentioned it. Well, actually, nor does Dante. There is a lot of discussion about what the sin is here. Because the demon says that Guido came to hell on account of his fraudulent advice, most people assume that this ditch is for those who advised fraud. But I'm not sure this works. Yes, Ulysses advised fraud with the Trojan horse and other ruses, but there are other things he did, such as stealing the holy statue of Troy, that did not involve fraudulent advice. And what about Diomedes, who's there along with Ulysses? He was the heavy guy with the strong arm, not the fraudulent tongue. I won't go into this whole debate, but I'll offer what, at least at the moment, I think is the ruling fraud of this section. I think these people broke faith with relationships. Remember that Ulysses turned away from his duty to his son, his father, and his wife, the three relationships he should have been most faithful to? He had only one relationship left to his mariners, and he broke that relationship too by leading them to their death on that Fole Volo. Even after death, joined in an intimate relationship with Diomedes in the same flame, Ulysses' tip of the flame recoils from contact with his companion. And Guido? Was his relationship to God a fraud? He became a friar, a servant of God, but not, as he tells us, out of love for God or for a life of good works, but only as an insurance policy to save his soul after death. That's not true relationship. And then he was false to his relationship to the Franciscans, betraying his bond with them when he thought it wouldn't do him any harm. There's no time to go further into this, but I want to paint as deplorable a picture as I can, because things get more and more gruesome as we come further down this pit of the inferno. The flames, no longer even pretending to be human here, hold no relationship sacred. They will set up a relationship with the family, with their followers, with St. Francis, with God, but will defraud the relationship whenever it suits them. Lunga promessa con la tender corto, long promise and short fulfillment. That's not the way to build community. It's the path to hell. And whew, that's it for us this evening under lamplight. Thanks for letting me share this with you, and come back next time for what I'm afraid will be the bloodiest episode in the Inferno. Bloody, but as you can be sure, fascinating. This has been Robert Louis Abrahamson with Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105. Shall we go out with Jethro Tull's witch's promise? The witch promised long but was short on fulfillment. The witch's promise is turning, so don't you wait up for him. He's going to be late.
Kissed by a witch one night in the wood, and later insisted your feelings were true. The witch's promise was coming, believing he listened while laughing you flew. Yellow, brown, all of the same. And the love you have found lay outside in the rain. Washed clean by the water, but